Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we want to start this hour with an update on a story unfolding in the U.S. military, which is sending hospital ships to U.S. cities, but also fighting the coronavirus within its ranks. Dozens of sailors on the aircraft carrier, the USS Theodore Roosevelt, are sick, and you may have heard that prompted a desperate letter from the carrier's commander to Navy officials asking if he could get everyone off the ship to clean it. Captain Brett Crozier wrote, "We are not at war. Sailors do not need to die." NPR's Tom Bowman joins us from the Pentagon. So, Tom, what is the latest?
Well, the latest is the Roosevelt is docked in Guam. And the ship's captain, as you mentioned, Brent Crozier, said in a letter to Navy officials he wanted to remove all 4,000 or so sailors, find lodging for them ashore, and disinfect the ship. He says the virus is ongoing and accelerating. We're hearing that positive coronavirus tests are anywhere from 50 to more than 200 at this point.
Well, he wrote in the letter, "If we do not act now, we are failing to properly take care of our most trusted asset, our sailors." We have been on carriers. I'm sure you have. It's almost claustrophobic for some people. It is so packed in there. But remind us how the Navy responded to the request?
Well, first of all, they said they're not going to take all those sailors off the ship, as the captain suggested. We talked last night, a group of reporters, with the top officer in the Pacific Fleet, Admiral John Aquilino. He said we're going to rotate sailors off, treat them, and then maybe send them back on the ship. We're looking for hotels in Guam to maybe we can have some of these sailors stay. They're bringing more test equipment and testing teams aboard to make this happen. But no sense at this point as far as how long this is going to take. And we kept pressing him. Listen, the captain wants everyone off this ship to deal with this issue. He said, we basically can't do that. We have to be ready at a moment's notice to, go to any crisis that happens in our area.
Yeah, well, here's Defense Secretary Mark Esper interviewed on CBS about the same thing last night. Here's what he said.
At this point in time, we're trying to make sure that we contain the virus, that we deploy testing kits so we get a good assessment of how much of the crew is infected, and then, of course, taking other measures to ensure we can get the carrier up and ready again to continue its mission.
Well, and there's that thought that you just expressed. The thinking is, what about the security if we need the carrier? Of course, if everyone's sick on the carrier, it won't go very well. And also, it can't be the only carrier that's like thinking there's only one cruise ship that has people sick.
Right. There is another carrier in the region, the Reagan, and that apparently there is a small number sick aboard that carrier, but that's in maintenance now. It really is not an issue.
Yeah. So overall, how is this pandemic affecting the military?
Well, they've curtailed training. They've curtailed bringing in new recruits. They've stopped travel for most service members. And there's a sense that it could affect the readiness of the force as well.
Yeah.
So that's something they're watching. And it continues to grow.
We will watch it with you. NPR's Tom Bowman at the Pentagon. Tom, thank you.
You're welcome, Robin.
Another thing we're watching across the country, more than 3 million people work as a home health aide, helping the elderly, the disabled, on average making less than $12 an hour. My mom had one, a godsend. But now these low-wage workers are on the front lines of a pandemic. Mallory Nopain of member station WVTF reports.
Karen Acra lives in a small town in Southern Virginia. She's a certified nurse assistant and has 3 patients she visits at home. That routine hasn't stopped as COVID-19 has spread. She is taking precautions. She always wears gloves, but she has a limited supply of masks and is having to spray them with Lysol and reuse them. She's not sure how sanitary that is. Advocates for home health workers are concerned. People like Acra are not getting the guidance or equipment they need to keep themselves and their patients safe.
There is no social distancing for home care workers. They are hands-on workers, and they are heroes.
David Broder is president of Virginia's chapter of SEIU, a union that represents home health workers. He says if they start getting sick, the virus could spread even faster.
And yet they're lacking personal protective equipment like masks and goggles and face shields. They're not getting training, and they lack the paid leave that they and their families need to take care of themselves as they're taking care of others.
Angelina Drake with the nonprofit Paraprofessional Healthcare Institute says there are steps state and federal officials can take now to support home health workers. One is to make it explicit in legislation and executive orders that home aides are a part of the essential healthcare workforce so they don't slip through the cracks. Another is remembering home healthcare agencies when distributing personal protective equipment.
We understand there's going to be a level of triage that happens that puts this equipment in the hands of frontline hospital and emergency room providers, but the home care workforce is right behind them.
Short of that, Drake asks for clear guidance from health departments on things like infection control, targeted specifically to home care workers. In the absence, caregivers are figuring things out for themselves. Azza Vandecastle lives in Northern Virginia and takes care of her 84-year-old mother. She has to go out for groceries and medication, but every trip feels dangerous.
Because if she died because of me, I will not forgive myself, you know?
So Vandecastle has been trying to do what she can. She covers her face with a scarf, keeps her distance from others, and showers as soon as she gets home. For NPR News, I'm Mallory Nopain in Richmond, Virginia.
To Japan now, which appeared to be a country that was getting a handle on coronavirus cases, but there's a concern now that limited testing has concealed the scale of the problem and that Japan should declare a state of emergency, which it has not yet done. Joining us now is CNN international correspondent Will Ripley, who's on Skype from Tokyo. Will, there are more than 2,000 coronavirus cases in Japan right now. That's not a lot compared to China, which has more than 82,000. But are officials worried the numbers will spike in Japan?
Well, they just haven't tested that many people. You have around 40,000 people who've been tested so far in a country of 125 million. And now you have a situation here in Tokyo that has some epidemiologists, including one I spoke to today, very worried. Because looking at the uptick in cases here in the Japanese capital in particular, he says it's very similar to what was seen in the early days in New York, for example.
Hmm. Why hasn't the government of Shinzo Abe declared a state of emergency? And what has the government been doing to address the pandemic?
Well, they are successful in some prefectures in terms of, you know, a very low percentage of people who are tested are testing positive. They're doing the contact tracing. But it seems as if here in Tokyo, things are starting to spiral a bit out of control. And yet Shinzo Abe held a press conference a short time ago saying that he still doesn't believe, after consulting with a panel of experts, that it rises to the level of a state of emergency. That said, they're still asking people to work from home, to avoid public transportation, to close bars and nightclubs, and to not gather in large groups. Some people are listening, some are not.
What about the economic picture? When you take all the effects that everybody around the world is feeling because of coronavirus, and add to that the fact that the Olympics that were supposed to be in Tokyo this summer have been postponed to next year, what are the concerns about the Japanese economy?
Well, we've been told by, for example, one economics professor that the cost to Japan when you combine the coronavirus pandemic with postponing the Olympics is going to be $36 billion. And that could be a conservative estimate, frankly. They've had tourism evaporate almost overnight. And making Japan a global destination was the cornerstone of Shinzo Abe's economic revival for Japan. He was counting on the Olympics to be that moment in the spotlight that made people want to come and visit this country in much larger numbers than they're doing now. But just today, Japan expanded its entry ban to foreign nationals traveling from a total of 73 countries. So basically, there are no foreign tourists coming here. You can't enter this country from a good portion of the world unless you're a Japanese citizen. And so you look at the streets in these traditionally packed tourist areas, they are dead quiet. And a lot of small businesses are really suffering.
Will, I just want to ask you one more thing, because while Japan doesn't have near the number of cases now that the United States does, Japan has been experiencing the coronavirus for longer than we have. We remember the Diamond Princess cruise ship that was docked off of Yokohama. You've been tweeting about joy and the importance of joy in this moment of fear. Just give us a sense of where that came from and whether we should be trying to do that in this country as well right now.
Several weeks ago, and I forget how long it was ago that I tweeted that video out, but I went to church on a Sunday because I needed a break from the news. And I was taken aback by how much people were really dragged down by everything that was happening. And, you know, as a member of the media, we were the ones delivering a lot of that bad news. I went back to my hotel room and I did something that I often do when I want to let off steam and also get some exercise. I was dancing in my room. I've never taken a video of the dancing in my room. And if you've seen the video, you can understand why. But I thought maybe this is something that can give people an idea of something that they can do to let off some steam and to remind themselves that there are still reasons to feel happy and to feel joy, even in these very difficult circumstances. And it's been really surreal to kind of see it take off. And people are still using the joy fights fear hashtag, which I'm really proud of. I am not planning on posting any more dancing videos, though, anytime soon.
I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit, Will. I think you could be in a Bollywood film, absolutely, after that.
Well, it's very kind of you. I think you're being very generous.
That is Will Ripley, CNN international correspondent, joining us from Tokyo. Will, thank you.
Hey, thanks so much. It's good to be with you.
And if you haven't seen that video, I just tweeted it out, at Jeremy Hobson.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
Whether you've tested positive for the coronavirus or know somebody who has had symptoms, we all have a lot of questions about COVID-19. And joining us to answer some of them is Jeffrey Shaiman, professor of environmental health sciences at Columbia University. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy.
Well, and the White House task force and the doctors there seem to think that the social distancing guidelines are working. Do you think they're working, or how big of an effect are they having on infection rates in the U.S. so far?
Well, there's some evidence that there is some slowing in the rate of growth in certain communities. Certainly, we've seen that on the West Coast in Seattle area, and we're seeing it just start to happen in New York City, which is encouraging. The reality, unfortunately, is that there's a very large delay between when an individual acquires SARS-CoV-2 and when they're actually confirmed for having it. I'm just going to walk you through this a little bit here. Mm-hmm. So if a person gets infected with a pathogen, they go through what's called a latent period, where the virus is growing in their body. They're not contagious. They're not shedding it. They're not symptomatic. That period probably is about 3 to 5 days. After that, they become contagious, and there's evidence that there's what's called pre-symptomatic shedding, that people shed the virus prior to the appearance of symptoms. And that period of time is about 1 to 3 days. Then once a person becomes symptomatic, their symptoms grow over time. They tend to worsen. And so that may be 3 to 5 days before somebody's symptoms are severe enough that they're motivated to go to the hospital, see a doctor, and they may actually become tested. And that time is another 3 days. You add all that up, and you're looking at a 10 to 16 day delay between when somebody acquired the infection and when they're actually confirmed for having it. And what that means is that when we see people today as confirmed cases, they acquired the infection a couple weeks ago. And a couple weeks ago, some of the interventions that are in place, for instance, right now in New York City, were not yet in place.
Right.
So we haven't seen the effects of those interventions and how they flatten the curve in terms of confirmed cases yet.
Okay, so let me ask you this. For people who have been basically self-quarantining for the last 2.5 or 3 weeks in some parts of the country, if they've been quarantining and a friend of theirs has been quarantining, is it okay at this point for them to get together, or do they still need to stay apart from each other?
I think the prudent thing would be to avoid that. And in a perfect world, that would be something sensible where you could do that. But the reality is most of us need to go out and still encounter other people along the way. You go out on the street and you're going to walk near people. You need to get groceries. You're going for essential services. You're going to places where other people are who may not have quarantined themselves and for which the virus may be present and may be able to circulate.
Let me ask you this, too, because I've talked to a number of people that I know who haven't been tested for COVID-19 because it's been too difficult for them to get a test. But it's pretty clear that they had it. They've got this symptom that many people have where they lose their sense of taste or smell. Once they have recovered or they don't have any symptoms anymore, is it okay for that person to start going out into the world again?
So this is an important question. And the way that people think about allowing this to happen, it's been suggested, is that people who have evidence that they have been infected, you can go do things and we can start to get the economy going again. And only people who haven't been exposed and have evidence of having been infected are required to use this social distancing and have more limited interaction. This is sort of predicated on the idea that people who are infected are not going to get infected again and then transmit it to someone else. We actually don't know if this is the case with this virus, which is really unfortunate. What we do know is that for the related endemic coronaviruses, there are four of them that circulate in humans all the time, that people get repeat infections with them. And if it happens on a rapid time scale, that would mean that, you know, within 6 months, a year, those people would be capable of being reinfected again and then transmitting to somebody else potentially.
What's your best guess about when this country is going to get back to normal, at least start opening back up?
Oh, boy. I wish I could give you a nice early date on all this. I think optimistically, if we can get a lid on this by, you know, let's say, oh boy, beginning of June, and if the virus itself has some seasonality to it, such that it's not as transmissible in our summertime here in the United States, we may catch a break and have it lighten up for a bit. But then we're going to have to really contend with, you know, battening down the hatches when it comes to September, if it is seasonal like that and it starts to ramp up in its transmissibility and its activity. We're in this for the long haul, and we have to figure out how we're going to get along with this virus until we can develop that vaccine or have an improved therapeutic that really limits the number of people who are suffering severe or critical reactions to it and dying from it.
That is Jeffrey Shaiman, a professor of environmental health sciences at Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health. Thank you so much again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, another question on many people's minds is, should we be wearing masks when we go out in public? Kerry Goldberg of member station WBUR went looking for answers.
Shan So Lin and Robert Hecht and their golden retriever, Spud, are out for their usual stroll in downtown Boston. So Lin is wearing a pink cloth mask, Hecht a black one, and Spud has a jaunty green shamrock print but isn't in the mood to wear it just now. In past days, the masks sometimes drew funny looks, but now the couple is seeing more passersby wearing masks as well.
There's a person with a bandeau.
Oh, yeah.
Jogging.
Jogging with a bandana. We like it.
Excellent.
So Lin and Hecht teach at Yale and run the nonprofit Pharos Global Health Advisors. And lately, they've become vocal advocates for wearing masks in public. Not the surgical type, healthcare staffers need those, but all the other non-medical types. So Lin says she looked into the research on how often people touch their faces, something health officials are telling people not to do because it can help spread the coronavirus.
The don't touch your face thing, while hugely important, is impossible for people to follow. And that's when I went down a rabbit hole of evidence.
And emerged with the conclusion that masks can be an important barrier against the virus. Hecht agrees.
We talked about what more could be done and that there was a glaring gap in the response throughout the United States around the use of masks, both to prevent being infected and spreading this very contagious disease.
The Centers for Disease Control currently recommends face mask use outside of healthcare settings only for people who are sick or caring for someone who's sick, not as a general precaution when out in public. It says masks should be saved for caregivers. State-level health officials have been saying much the same, that the public does not need face masks, but healthcare workers do. Here's Massachusetts Health Commissioner Monica Barrell.
The face mask does not protect us, so none of us need to be wearing face masks.
You might notice a logical inconsistency there. If a mask can protect a healthcare worker, why wouldn't it protect someone else? Harvard epidemiologist Mark Lipsitch explains it's a question of priorities.
The public health message came in part because of a concern about shortages and the sense that it's more valuable to protect healthcare workers than to protect low-risk members of the general population.
That makes sense, he says.
We have to increase production of masks, and we do have to make sure that the healthcare system gets them first, or we're going to have no healthcare workers because they'll be sick and they'll be in quarantine.
But that's manufactured masks, like surgical masks and the more elaborate N95 masks. In recent days, the CDC has shifted its guidelines to allow healthcare workers to use improvised masks in some settings, even bandanas. And there's a great wave of volunteers making do-it-yourself masks. Hospitals are posting mask-making how-to videos and accepting donations. So do these masks work? Lipsitch says there's just not very good data about the effects of the general public wearing masks and improvised masks to boot. But there's a leading researcher whose work he respects most.
Hi, this is Ben Cowling. I'm a professor of infectious disease epidemiology at the University of Hong Kong.
From what Cowling reports in a recent paper, it sounds like Hong Kong basically has an unofficial universal mask rule.
In Hong Kong, we have now 99% of people wearing face masks in the community, on the street, in public transport, and often still indoors in offices as well.
And Hong Kong is one of the places that has had some success in beating back COVID-19. Cowling says he thinks widespread masks contributed, but that other measures like widespread testing and physical isolation were more important. Overall, he says, the research on masks for protection against viruses is very limited and the results have been mixed. But he suggests the people at highest risk for COVID-19 complications might want to consider them anyway.
My conclusion of the research is that perhaps there's a small effect, maybe a 5% or 10% reduction in the risk of transmission if people wear face masks, probably not a very large effect.
And many people are not waiting for more research. Masks are multiplying on the streets of many cities in the U.S. and around the world. In the Czech Republic, face masks are now mandatory in all public spaces. Ben Cowling says the masks can fail if they're worn wrong or taken off incorrectly. So no matter how popular face masks get, if it's a choice between going out to a crowded area with a mask on or staying home, he says staying home is definitely safer. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
Airlines have been canceling flights, and Spirit announced that it would suspend all flights to New York area airports after the CDC urged residents of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut to help stop the spread of COVID-19 by stopping all non-essential travel. But other airlines are still flying in and out of COVID-19 hotspots, even if at limited capacity. So let's bring in Seth Kaplan, Here Now's transportation analyst. And Seth, what are you hearing? Can other airlines maybe also cancel all flights to places like New York City?
Robin, we reached out to the big four U.S. airlines today, which account for about 85% of the industry, heard back from two of them, and they were both pretty unequivocal in saying, no, they're not going to do it. American told me their, quote, critical infrastructure, they and other airlines, that, you know, they're carrying medical professionals getting to where needed, that they're just responding to demand. When they reduce flights, it's because not many people are traveling. Southwest told me something similar. It said, of course, don't be surprised to see reductions to places like New York and New Orleans, it mentioned as well, but that they're absolutely going to keep flying as there are people who need to get places.
Well, you mentioned they're carrying medical professionals. We've seen that viral photo of healthcare pros on the way to New York. They're smiling, making heart signs with their hands. They're going to help. Governor Cuomo said, please come. But are airlines making accommodations to help them get there?
It sounds like the precautions that they're taking in terms of deep cleaning the planes and fogging the planes, kind of like they always did after international flights, some of these airlines, are universal for all passengers. Southwest did say that one accommodation it's made is letting hospitals which have in some cases big banks of tickets that they usually use for medical transport to transport patients, to instead use that to transport medical professionals because they're not moving patients around the country anymore.
Yeah, I was hoping they'd get some maybe some free flights. But it's funny, we began talking about airplane flight weeks ago. Remember, we were talking about how planes are actually safe and that they have filtered air systems. It's the person sneezing on you that's a problem. Right. But then we're also hearing airlines now have consolidated routes so much, some flights are full. So when you're in the air, are people sitting 6 feet apart?
Not always. In many cases, yes, because there are flights that are still somewhat empty. But yeah, a few weeks ago, we had flights where you'd hear about just like two or three people on them. Now airlines are removing so many flights that I have heard reports of flights that are rather full. And exactly like we spoke about a few weeks ago, nothing different about an airplane. Simply, you're just on there with other people. And if there are a lot of people, you're exposed to the same things as you would be in any room full of a lot of other people.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is kind of a race to the bottom here between falling demand and falling airline capacity. And you know, once you get airlines reducing almost all of their flights, you can have a flight somewhat fill up anyway, even with not many people traveling.
By the way, quick travel tip, you can still get some of those cleanse wipes that are sold out everywhere if you go to the little travel sections of the drugstores where they have little packets of things. And I got a bunch of little packets of those wipes so you can wipe the bathroom door and things like that. Meanwhile, we only have about a half a minute. Are airlines going to get some grants and loans to prop them up?
Yeah, the $50 billion total in available grants and loans. The grants are to pay the employees, to keep people employed through September 30th. We're talking about the employees at the mainline airlines. Yep. I mean, lots of other pain around the industry, people without those kinds of guarantees.
Yep.
The loans, we'll see what happens. There are strings attached that some of these airlines might not want to take if they can borrow money elsewhere.
Seth Kaplan here, now's transportation analyst. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, it is that time of the week now. Let's take a break from the news for a few minutes for a quarantine edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Joining us now is Chris Derides, a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. He joins us from home today. Chris, from my house to your house, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, so far your dog is being cooperative.
Midas is being very good right now. He's standing by for the quarantunes that we're about to bring people. Now, this is, by the way, an interesting time for DJs because you can't do anything that's in a public setting, but a lot of DJs have taken to social media to live stream stuff. Have you been doing that?
I haven't been doing that, but we're able to program KCRW stuff from home. So I've been dropping in songs onto Eclectic 24. Ann Litt's been hosting Morning Becomes Eclectic. So we're generating new programming, albeit from home.
All right. Well, let's get to some of the songs that you have brought us today that might capture the mood of the quarantine that many Americans are in right now. First off, we've got Hello Walls. This is by Willie Nelson.
Hello, walls.
Hello.
Hello. How'd things go for you today? Don't you miss her? Since she up and walked away, and I'll bet you dread to spend another lonely night with me. But lonely walls, I'll keep you company.
I think we could all be singing this song right now, Chris, to our walls.
You know, it's as a DJ, you can't really put a song on the air without it having some kind of context of our current situation, right? This was my son's idea, and he's holed up at his apartment in the Echo Park area of Los Angeles with his fiance. He's got two cats and a dog. He has plenty of distractions, but somehow talking to walls resonated with him. It's 1962 this song came out. Willie Nelson wrote this during a pretty prolific time for him. Late 50s, he wrote it, at a time when he also wrote Funny How Time Slips Away and Nightlife and Crazy, which, of course, became a big hit for Patsy Cline.
Okay, well, the next one that you've brought us is a great song by Sam Cooke. This is Another Saturday Night.
Another Saturday. I seen a lot of girls assisting. If I could meet them, I could get them. But as yet, I haven't met them. That's why I'm in the shape I'm in. Here another Saturday night.
You know, I feel like almost any song about a breakup or being single would work in a quarantine right now.
Yes. Well, I was drawn to this one, honestly, because the song, I guess he wrote it. As the story goes, he was cooped up at the Mayfair Hotel. He was touring in England. And the hotel policy barred him from having female guests in his suite. So he left that hotel, and he downgraded to a smaller, less prestigious hotel, hoping that they would let him do whatever he wanted. But the policy still shut him down. So he ended up writing this at the sound check for his gig in the dressing room.
Well, I'm wondering whether one of the songs you've brought us today is going to be Eric Carmen's All By Myself, but I'm looking at the list and no, that is not on your list. But what is next is Shut-Ins. This is by Curtis Stigers and Larry Goldings.
Let's be shut-ins, shut-ins. We'll stay in, see the day in the private way that we do. Let the riffraff and the rabble go out. I'd rather be a shut-in with you.
Chris, you're making me feel a little bit better about this whole quarantine situation.
Well, this is the only song on the list that's brand new, that sort of, you know, came out of the current situation that we're in a way. The story is, originally it was just a love song that Bill was writing for his girlfriend because they're both homebodies and they never leave the house. And they, you know, so it was just for that. But now, the demo 2 weeks ago took on a whole nother meaning, like it was some kind of postcard to their future selves. And so they sent it to their friend Curtis Stigers, who's this jazz singer who's originally from Idaho, and maybe he would react to it. Curtis went in the studio 2 weeks ago and recorded the vocal, and they sent it to me 2 days ago. So this is a brand new song. They just put it up on YouTube, and you know, it's just such a comforting little thing.
All right, well, from Shut-Ins and Hello Walls, we go now to Our House, of course. This is by Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young.
Such a cozy room. Such a cozy room. The windows are illuminated by the evening sunshine through them, fiery gems for you.
You know, I am hoping that, like me, our listeners are thinking to themselves as they're listening to this, rather than, why aren't they talking about the coronavirus? Wow, this is such a nice break from talking about the coronavirus. But tell us more about this one.
Well, I guess I heard this first when I was a kid. My dad had this album, Deja Vu, you know, 1970 it came out. I wore that album out, especially this song, which is a song, that's a pretty intense album, but this song appeals to kids, right? I had no idea that it was written by Graham Nash, that he was writing it while he was living with Joni Mitchell in Laurel Canyon here in Los Angeles. But that just, to me, just adds to the majesty of the song. you know, what must domestic life have been like for those two? And it's really, I think, just a portrait of an ordinary moment. And that's what's so comforting about it. We're all having these very ordinary moments right now.
Well, last but not least, Chris, you have brought us Someday We'll Be Together, of course, by Diana Ross and the Supremes.
Someday we'll be together. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You'll fall away from me, my love. But just as sure.
Giving me hope right now, Chris, that indeed someday we'll be together. I don't think it's going to be Easter, but it could be, you know, I don't know, May, June.
Summer. Gosh, I remember the first time I heard this song. I specifically know where I was. I was in the back seat of my parents' car, and I was leaning forward between the front seats, mesmerized by the radio, knowing that my parents were splitting up. So this song always feels a little bittersweet to me. But the Supremes don't actually sing on the song, but one of the writers, Johnny Bristol, who was producing the track, he's singing with Diana Ross on the track. But it's just such a timeless, hopeful song about, yeah, maybe one day we'll all be back together.
All right, well, if that day does not come soon, we'll bring you back for some more songs that we can dance our quarantine away to. That is Chris DeRitas, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California, working from home in West LA. Chris, thank you so much as always.
Jeremy, always good to talk to you. Be well.
You too. And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. We are NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
You don't have to search too far to find stories that will renew your faith in humanity. People falling all over themselves, for instance, to make face masks, but some will look better than others. If you watch season 19 of Bravo's Project Runway, you might recognize this voice, a judge disappointing contestants.
This was certainly not easy, but we felt we had no other option but to send both of you home.
Oh, but he was so nice about it. That's fashion designer Brandon Maxwell, who's created gowns for superstars like Lady Gaga and Meghan Markle. And now he's turned his attention to making hospital gowns and face masks with his team. Brandon, when did you decide to do this?
You know, about 2 weeks ago, we transitioned to work from home. And, you know, one part of that process was to, you know, move the seamstresses and pattern makers out of the office and fully set up studios for themselves and myself in our homes. So many people actually in our office, their families work in the medical field, and we identified sort of early on that they would be needing supplies. So we have really diligently been working towards doing our best to help where we can.
Well, I have a friend, Heather, who decided she was going to sit down and make masks too. And she said it took her an hour to figure out how to thread the machine. She hadn't done it in so long. So here you are. You've got professionals, 12 in-house employees now at home, some volunteers, and companies that have donated some cotton.
Yeah, we were really lucky that, you know, Pantone reached out, and the cotton bolts that they do their color swatching on, they were so kind to offer. And, you know, when we started, we had made a statement and spoken to people about the idea that we were, you know, going to be continuing a dialogue as a company to figure out what this meant and how to do this best. And, you know, as I knew about the fashion community, which I think a lot of people see the fashion community very differently, I know that it's a very familial community and a very loving community. And we've seen so many people come together to send a pattern or send a resource or send an idea. Or as we start to figure out to make this mask or the gown, more resources come in from someone else to say, this is what we should be doing differently or better. So, you know, we've just been really grateful and blessed for everybody who has given us information. And we've also really, I think, come together as a group during this time. And that's been really comforting.
Oh, well, also, I can't wait to see what, you know, some of the patterns are. But we're presuming you're not doing the N95 masks. These are the really intense masks that screen out the COVID-19 virus. But even the just, you know, the regular masks that go across the face are so valuable for nurses and doctors. Have you been able to send them out? I mean, how many are you making?
Yes. So we really, what we started with first was we identified that we were going to be making gowns. And so the process of that, finding that fabric was really, really important. And you can imagine that that was not an easy process, and also a process that everyone was sort of clamoring for that fabric. And we started working with a material that was not breathable enough last week. Now we're waiting on getting a different medical grade fabric this week. Pantone, in the meantime, has donated the 100% cotton that we'll be using to create the mask cover. So last week was really about making many, many prototypes of the right breathable gowns and figuring out where we were going to go with the mask. And we would love to include filters that are commonly used as air filters to include in our mask for an added layer of protection. So this week we're really focusing on solidifying the gowns and also making these mask covers that have the protective filters in them.
And so I'm just going to repeat what you said. If anyone out there has the filter part, Brandon Maxwell could use them for the cover, for the cotton cover part that he and his staff are making. And you want to have 750 masks and 60 to 100 gowns going out per week. They will be much needed.
Yes, we would love to. You know, I think that one thing that I knew about my team but has extra amazed me during this time is, you know, obviously we're also still, we're a small company, we're also a working company, so much of our production that would be being done in factories we're now doing in-house to meet the needs of you know, our day-to-day business that has to go out. And outside of these quote-unquote traditional work hours, we see everyone putting in extra time just with their hearts to meet these needs. And so that's what we feel that we can realistically do per week.
Well, again, I hope that you give them a little Brandon Maxwell flair, because the nurses and doctors, they need protection, but they could probably use that too. But we also understand you're giving away 3 gowns to brides in need. Now, what? Just briefly, what are the stories there? What happened?
Well, you know, we have prided ourselves as a company on playing a small part in women's special days, whether that's, you know, a wedding or red carpet. We decided sort of on day one that for women who, you know, have been affected financially by this, we have decided to give away 3 wedding gowns. And the most amazing thing is I've had Gigi Burris, my friend who's a milliner, Ava Farron, who does gorgeous jewelry, Kayla Erlanger, who's a celebrity stylist. Everybody has come together when we launched this to basically give an incredible 360-day package to 3 women who have been affected by this crisis.
Yeah, well, good for you for that, too. That's fashion designer Brandon Maxwell. Thank you so much for what you're doing. And again, let us see it when you have the final product.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's like cellist Yo-Yo Ma said to us, Jeremy, just do what you can do. And he is. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.